Aristotle was an ancient Greek philosopher who lived over 2,000 years ago. He was one of the first scientists, one of the first people to look at the natural world and try to explain what he saw in terms of causes and effects. So he had some good ideas. He also had some not so good ideas. We're going to look at one of the latter today. Suppose that Aristotle woke from the dead, violating the second law of thermodynamics, but we'll ignore that, and came to Perimeter. He saw that physicists here were overturning some of his work, so he got really angry and decided to gather an army and besiege Perimeter. He was going to stand outside it and bombard us until we gave in. So he might use a cannon like the one that we saw earlier this morning. Now, who would like to tell me, if a cannon ball is shot out of this cannon, what is the shape of the trajectory that the cannonball makes? Parabola, thank you. We probably all know that, but Aristotle didn't know that. He thought that the cannonball would make a shape more like this. He believed that the cannon gave the cannonball what we've translated as an impetus that would cause the cannonball to move just in one direction. When the cannonball ran out of impetus, it would fall as far as it could to the Earth's center. So this shape might look funny to us because we know about parabolas. But it reminded me of some systems. There are some projectile systems near the Earth's surface that start out like this, but don't go like that. Can anyone think of such a system?
Probably fast-moving rocket.
Okay, a fast-moving rocket. But does it eventually go in a parabola unless it has escape velocity? Maybe you're thinking of that?
Yeah, I'm thinking of
specifically. Okay, that's one system. Any other systems?
Angry birds.
Sorry? Angry birds. Okay. A system that would have very interesting physics for another talk. I thought of a fly in honey, like the honey near the bistro. Not that the bistro has flies, just honey. A fly in honey might get stuck in the honey. It might follow more of a linear trajectory, might not make much of a parabola. Why is that? We might be thinking of viscosity. The honey's viscosity prevents the fly from feeling very much gravity. We can generalize this idea of what can make a system start out like this without moving like that near the Earth's surface. In order to generalize the idea, we need to meet the Reynolds number. I'd like to find out under what, if any, conditions a cannonball near the Earth's surface can move more like Aristotle thought it would than like we think it would. So, since meeting Greek ballistics, we have identified this guiding question in red. We're going to talk about this mysterious Reynolds number, look at some examples of it, and apply it to Aristotle's canon. Okay. The Reynolds number was introduced during the 1800s by Osborne Reynolds. He used it to describe systems that consist of an object moving through a medium, like a cannonball moving through air, or a fly moving through honey, or a human swimming in a swimming pool. He defined the Reynolds number like this. Rho stands for the medium's mass density. V stands for a characteristic speed, maybe of the object, maybe of the medium, depends on the system. L represents a characteristic length scale. For example, the diameter of the cannonball or the diameter of a pipe through which fluid flows. And eta represents the fluid's viscosity. What does the Reynolds number mean? It's a ratio of two forces, the inertial to the viscous. If there's fluid flowing, then since it's moving, it has inertia, so it pushes the object forward. That's what I mean by inertial force, but when we see that in the numerator, we should also keep in mind the inertia that the object has, for instance, because it's been shot out of a cannon. I'll return to the inertia of the object later. In the denominator, we have the viscous force. So the inertial force pushes the object forward, the viscous force pulls the object backward. This is a picture of a scallop, which appears in an article I'll discuss shortly. Okay. Physicists, especially at Perimeter, like to talk about the world of the large differing from the world of the small. The Reynolds number divides our world into two such worlds, but both are classical. The first is the world of large Reynolds number. That's our world. The motion in this world is called turbulent flow. It's non-linear. You can think of rapids in a river. There are a lot of eddies, a lot of swirls. The system is non-linear. It's not time reversible. The world of small Reynolds number is characterized by a motion called laminar flow. Things move a lot more slowly. The equation of motion, which describes fluid mechanics, is the Navier-Stokes equation. In the low Reynolds number approximation, it doesn't depend on time. So there's actually an interesting example of how such systems can be time reversible. If you'd like to know more, I can tell you about it during the Q&A session. One resource that was referred to me pretty much anytime anyone mentioned the Reynolds number to me was Purcell's Life at Low Reynolds Number. It's a fun introduction, an informal introduction, but it's a really interesting perspective on what is life is like for an E. coli bacterium. It also has plenty of hand-drawn pictures, and any article that has hand-drawn pictures of swimmers must be a good article. This one can remind us that by tweaking different parameters in the Reynolds number formula, we can get a feel for what life is like in worlds of different values of the Reynolds number. For example, most of us know what it's like to be a person swimming in a pool. But think of a bacterium swimming in the pool. What does that feel like? It feels approximately like we would feel swimming through molasses. Worlds of different Reynolds numbers, this small Reynolds number world of the bacterium in the pool or the human in molasses really feels a lot different than the large Reynolds number world of the human in the swimming pool. Just some more facts. The Reynolds number is dimensionless. It crops up in many areas of physics, and it involves order of magnitude approximations, which we're going to look at now. The first approximation is that of a fly in honey. These are the values that I've approximated for parameters in the Reynolds number definition. I found that indeed, the Reynolds number for the fly is less than one. Example number two is the cannonball moving through air. These are my parameters values, and I found that indeed, the Reynolds number is quite large. That's why the cannonball moves as we think it would, because we live in the large Reynolds number world. Now, remember our guiding question. Under what conditions could a cannonball near the Earth's surface move more like Aristotle thought it would than like we think it would? Well, I found under what conditions the cannonball would have low Reynolds numbers. I used the Reynolds number formula in order to find an appropriate viscosity, to find under what conditions the Reynolds number would be small. Found that the viscosity would need to be about 100 Pascal seconds. What kind of a fluid is that? Turns out that peanut butter has about this viscosity. Now think about a cannonball flying through peanut butter, and you're thinking of a low Reynolds number system. I wanted to check that the viscosity force would indeed be felt by the cannonball much more than the gravitational force, so the cannonball wouldn't be pulled into a parabola. I used the Stokes law in order to calculate the friction force. That's this equation. I found that the friction force is about 20,000 newtons. I used our favorite F equals mg equation in order to calculate the gravitational force, found that that equals about 50 newtons. And indeed, the gravitational force affects the cannonball much less than the frictional force. The cannonball doesn't go so much like this. But even if Aristotle stuck a bunch of peanut butter in front of his cannon, so that he found that the cannonball moved in a satisfactory trajectory, it wouldn't move far. This is another characteristic of life at low Reynolds numbers. Remember I mentioned the object's inertia. That doesn't carry you far if you have a low Reynolds number. The cannonball would move for only about 10 to the negative third seconds. The object pretty much forgets what happened in the past almost immediately. So Aristotle's cannonball could make an okay shape through the peanut butter, but again, it wouldn't go far. In conclusion, we've seen, first that Greek ballistics were wrong in some ways. Second, we saw the definition of the Reynolds number. We saw that it divides the natural world, the classical world, into the world of the large Reynolds number and the world of the small Reynolds number. Large Reynolds number is characterized by the inertial force, and by a turbulent flow. The small Reynolds number realm is characterized more by the viscous force, which pulls an object backward, and by laminar, smooth, slow flow. The small Reynolds number world is time reversible. In it, momentum can't carry you very far, even though it can carry you far in the large Reynolds number world. And our most important conclusion, there are some conditions under which it seems that a cannonball would move more as Aristotle thought it would, near the Earth's surface, than as we think that it would. But again, you'd have to put a bunch of peanut butter in front of the cannonball, it wouldn't go far, so I think that we're safe from Aristotle's ghost. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Yes, I have a general question. So when viscosity is large, we have low, typically low Reynolds numbers, right? When is the gravity more important, during the motion with high Reynolds numbers or during the motion with low Reynolds numbers?
So the question is about the role of gravity and when it plays an important role in terms of in systems of high Reynolds numbers or low Reynolds numbers.
Yeah.
So as you said, in general, when there's high viscosity, then we are in a world of low Reynolds number because the viscosity is in the denominator of the definition, although you can tweak parameters so that things are different. In this case, world of large Reynolds number is characterized by inertial force, which really is the force more of the fluid that is flowing, as opposed to gravity. But in this case, I just wanted to show that not only is the flow of the medium not affecting the cannonball very much, but because of the Reynolds number, we can see that and that the viscosity force is dominant. And we can also, in addition, see that the viscosity force is much greater than the gravitational force. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't make necessarily an a priori conclusion about the importance of gravity based on just the Reynolds number.
Okay, sure.
Curious, how far would the cannonball go in peanut butter?
Okay, so we saw that it would move for about 0.001 seconds, and I approximated its initial velocity as 10 to the second meters per second.
100, okay.
Yeah, I'm just using order of magnitude estimates.
Yeah. Okay.
So multiply 10 to the second times 10 to the negative third, so which is about 0.1 meters.
Yeah.
Not far. So we would be fairly safe, I think. Any others?
Do you have any idea which systems Aristotle was thinking of when he postulated that move like this?
He was talking about cannonballs.
Really? How? So he couldn't be saved by viscosity because he wasn't describing cannonball in peanut butter.
Right. So it's just that he came up with an incorrect theory of ballistics. He thought that a cannonball moves like this. What I was saying is that we know that a cannonball moving through air, as Aristotle was talking about, does not move like that. But are there any conditions under which a cannonball near the Earth's surface could move more as Aristotle thought than as we know that it actually does? Does that make more sense? Okay.
Did he have talents? Did they have talents?
In this case, it's more projectiles.
Like, what do you call it? Catapults?
I was thinking more projectiles in general. Then during the Middle Ages, his theory was elaborated upon. His theory was pretty much embedded in Western Europe during the Middle Ages, and it was elaborated on a little. So there were slight variations on that shape, but it was about the same, and warfare developed a little.
Be the last question. So you've shown us some funny examples of how to use the Reynolds number. Do you have some practical use of Reynolds numbers? Sure.
It is used a lot in biophysics, geophysics, subjects like that. So for instance, it comes up in biophysics when people are trying to understand how a microorganism can move. Swimming is a problem in the world of low Reynolds numbers. If you were a microorganism wondering how you can swim, you might think maybe of using paddles. And you might think, well, if I move down really quickly, then I'll propel myself forward a lot. Then I can return to my paddles to their initial position so I can propel myself again. But that doesn't work for reasons I can go into in a separate conversation. So instead, microorganisms, because they have low Reynolds numbers, had to develop different techniques, like using a flagellum that corkscrews. It never has to go in the opposite direction in order to be periodic. Or cilia, which propel themselves like this, and then return periodically to their initial position while deforming themselves so that they don't have to push backwards against the fluid, like that. So there are a few applications.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker.
Thank you.
Great, so and our next speaker is Tian, and he is going to talk about surface gravity waves.
Oh, hello everyone. I'm going to talk about the surface gravity wave. Notice I'm not talking about gravitational wave. It is just some fluid mechanics. The surface gravity wave is the mechanical wave that propagates on the surface of the water. So simply speaking, it is water wave. And because the restoring force of such wave are mainly the surface tension and the gravity, so it's how the name comes from. Okay. I'm going to talk about a simple model for the surface gravity wave. And I'll give you the simplifying basic assumptions and a solution in the special case. Also, I'm going to answer this question, why are the sea waves always parallel to the shore on the beaches? So why do I choose this topic? As you know, the water wave may be the most familiar wave to us. And see this beautiful picture, you can see the waves propagating on the surface clearly when the wind blows, or you can just touch the water or throw something, throw a rock into it, and the wave motion is really intuitive. But the water wave is not so simple as it looks like. For example, the so-called surface gravity wave is neither longitudinal wave as the sound wave nor transverse wave as the light wave. Also, the dispersion relation of the water wave is non-trivial. And I'm going to figure out this problem using the so-called Airy wave theory, because it was first published by Airy in 19th century. It is also referred to as linear wave theory because it's a linear approximation for this question. Okay, to build our model, we need some simplifying assumptions, and we assume the water to be inviscid, irrotational, and incompressible. So let's translate this assumption into mathematical languages. The water is inviscid, that is to say we only need to consider about the pressure in the water, and there is no viscous forces. And the water, the velocity field of the water is irrotational. That is to say, the curl of the velocity field is zero. Therefore, it's possible for us to find the so-called velocity potential for this velocity field. And the velocity field is the gradient of the velocity potential. And we also assume the water to be impressible, that is to say the density of the wave is a constant. And because of the conservation of the mass, we can derive that the derivative, the divergence of the velocity field is also zero. Therefore, we got the Laplacian equation for the velocity potential. Okay. So now we got this wonderful differential equations, and we can solve it in certain boundary conditions. And I'm going to set up a simple case. See, this is a graph for the water wave we are going to consider about. Here is the depth of the water. We denoted it by capital H, and we assume the depth of the water is a constant. And where z equals to minus h, it is the bottom of the water, and where z equals to zero, it is the surface. And we use a function eta to describe the shape of the surface of the water. And we assume this function is a sine function, and it is propagating. Eta equals to a sine kx minus omega t. The amplitude A is also assumed to be small so that we can linearize our boundary conditions. Also, it is assumed that the wave motion is uniform in the y direction. All the variables are not depending on the y variable. And now we can list the boundary conditions. On the surface of water, it is the boundary conditions are all about the velocity of the water in the z direction. That is the partial derivative of the velocity potential in the z direction, and it is the rate of the change of the shape of the surface of water at the surface, where there equals zero, and it is required to be zero on the bottom. So they are in fact linearized boundary conditions, and we have dropped some higher order term, but still this seems intuitive, such the velocity to be zero, that the velocity in the direction to be zero at the bottom, and it changes with the surface as z equals zero. Okay, now with these two boundary conditions and the shape we have assumed to be a sine function, we are able to solve the Laplacian equation for the velocity potential phi, and this is the solution with an amplitude depending on omega k and also the depth, depth of the water, h, and the cz parameter, and with the propagating term cosine kx minus omega t. Now we can explain the first problem. Why is the surface gravity wave is neither longitude and nor transverse? You just take derivative of the velocity potential and the Gauss velocity field, and you see both the x component and z component are not zero. So when the surface gravity wave is propagating, there are both motion in the direction same to the propagating direction and tangent to the propagating direction. It is not longitude nor transverse. Also, we have another constraint for the surface gravity wave. It comes from the unsteady Bernoulli equation, and we have dropped the higher order terms off, such as the square of the velocity. And the linearized form reversion is like this. And there the dynamical variables appear. Here is the gravity, and sigma is the surface tension coefficient. And the Bernoulli equations told us like this. And just plug our solution to it, we got the dispersion relation of the surface gravity wave, and it is highly non-trivial. You have omega squared and k to the 3, and also tangent kh. And we are going to make some applications of this dispersion relation and answer the question we have asked in the beginning. So as you go to the beaches, you will always see the sea waves coming to you, and they are always parallel to the shore. And why is this? Record this dispersion relation, and we can simplify it on the beaches. So on the beaches near the shore, the wavelength of the water wave is rather large, but the water is really shallow, so that we have small k and h. And when g is much bigger than sigma k squared over rho, we have this gravity term larger than the surface tension term, so the gravity dominance, and we will drop this term. Also, when the water is shallow, k is smaller enough, we can pick up the kh term out of the tangent function. And therefore, the dispersion relation for the water waves near the shore is just this simple equation, omega squared equals to gh k squared.
2 minutes.
OK. So the velocity of the wave is c equals to square root of gh, and it does not depend on the wave number k, but it does depend on the depth of the water. So on the beaches where the depth of the water is decreasing gradually, we have the wave velocity is also decreasing gradually. So since the velocity is changing, the water wave will be diffracted, and it ends up in propagating perpendicular to the shore. Okay, so I have explained this question, and in conclusion, we have built a model for inviscid, inrotation, and incompressible water, and describe how the water waves related to the surface tension and gravity propagating in it. And the method we use is just to solve the Laplacian equation for certain boundary conditions, and we've got the velocity field, and we know that it is not the wave is not longitudinal nor transverse. And we also studied the dispersion relation. Okay, that's all. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
So when it isn't perpendicular, when it isn't coming straight in, what would cause it not to deviate from that? Because, I mean, when you go to the beach, they aren't always coming straight in.
Because the beach, the beach is the depth of the water is changing gradually, and you may study that you maybe use some such as famous theorem, and you know that the wave is propagating in the way where the I don't know the terminology, but as the light propagating into the water. You know the light propagating in smaller speed in the water than in the air, so it will bend to the water. It's like this, and near the shore, the velocity is small, so the water wave is propagating like this way. It is bending to and in the end, the wave is parallel to the shore. But it does not happen when the shore, the depth is not changing gradually, such as in the lake outside, the water will reflecting to the shore, and it does not seem parallel.
No more questions? So let us thank the speaker.
Thank you. Oh.
Okay, and our next speaker is Yang Gang, and he's going to talk about physics of hanging props.
Good morning, everyone. Today, my topic is very simple, the physics of hanging ropes. Here are two pictures I took in Waterloo. They are really pretty house. It's quite different from the house in China. However, these two photos kind of disappoint me because of the power line. I tried to use the Photoshop to remove it, but now I need to thank it. I need to thank them because they give me the inspiration about today's topic. What inspired me once again is this spider web just on the pool, on the water pool around the Pi building. You can see this spider web is made of hundreds of hanging ropes. So what I'm going to talk about is the hanging rope. It's everywhere in our everyday life. First, I built the physics model of the hanging rope in order to figure out the exact shape of it. And after that, I can give you some example about the application. So first, let's build a physics model. So this is a hanging rope. We support it at this at the two end of the rope, and just put it freely in the gravitational field. The basic method to analyze the hanging rope is using the force diagram. Let's study this part of the rope. We can see, the two lines pulling this line segment create the tension T and T zero. And we have gravity. Since this rope is at rest, so the net force and on every part of the rope should be zero. And then we can get the differential equations for this rope and find out the shape of the rope. This is a very simple method, isn't it? Even the high school student can come up with this idea. I prefer to use so-called much more advanced and more elegant method. That is, we can see this problem from another aspect, the potential energy. Here is the potential energy. Let's see this very small line segment. The length of the line segment, dl, can be expressed like this. If we multiply this by the, this is the mass per unit length, y is the height, is the shape of the rope. And we do the integration, then we can get the potential energy. In principle, if the hanging rope is at rest, stay in a very stable stage, then the potential energy should reach its minimum. What we try to do is to find the minimum of the U. Note, here U is a functional rather than a function, because the variables of this function is y to x and y prime to x, which are also functions. How can we find the minimum value of the functional? Functional calculus tell us if the variable y to x is changed by a very small amount, which we called epsilon here, delta u is zero, then this function, this functional can reach its minimum value. So from this, actually, this functional differentiation can give us the very famous Euler-Lagrange equation, which I put it here. This Euler-Lagrange equation is the core equation we use here to figure out the exact shape of the rope. So I skip the very detailed calculation and I put the result here. Here is the result. Y2x is given by A cosine x over A, which turned out to be a hyperbolic cosine shape. The parameter A here is given by T0, which is the tension at the bottom point over the dou G. So this figure gives us the relation of the parameter A to the shape of the rope. We can see from this figure that as the parameter A becomes larger, the shape of the rope becomes more straight or less curved. Here I can give an example. If the rope becomes heavier, then the parameter A becomes smaller, which corresponds to the black rope. Okay, the black curve. It is more curved. So this makes sense that a heavier rope a heavier rope correspond to a more U-shaped rope. So here we get a conclusion that the exact shape of the hanging rope is a hyperbolic cosine function rather than the parabola or the other kind of curves. Finally, I'll give you some example about of the application. From this picture, we can see whether it is the very famous landmark, is it called Golden Gate Bridge, in San Francisco, or the very simple suspension bridge we can see it in the countryside. We can all find the hyperbolic cosine shape here. So why do the architect prefer this shape in the arc to build the bridge? There is the advantage that using this bridge, the weight of the bridge can be spread all over the rope, so that it's much easier to support the total weight of the bridge. So let's see another two pictures. They are a bit different from the previous ones, since they are an upside down, inverse U shape rather than the U shape. The inverse U and U are almost the same, except that the tension in the previous case become the compression. So the first picture shows the shape of the hyperbolic cosine function. It has a very long history. This picture is taken in Iraq. A very old, I think it's a historic heritage. And this picture is another very famous landmark in the US, called the Gate Arch. I forgot its name. It's actually a weighted shape rather than the original shape, the original hyperbolic cosine shape. Because the model of this building is actually a weighted shape, weighted rope, which means the weight of this part, the weight of the rope at this part is heavier than this part. So we can see as the time goes by, the architecture, the architect is trying to find a better shape to support the building, and the shape, the hyperbolic cosine shape is also evolving. So this is a very simple presentation, and here is these are my references. Okay, thank you very much.
So what was the problem that you ran into when you tried to Photoshop out the water in your photos?
Which photo? Sorry.
One of your first slides.
You see the power lines here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, this gave me some hints about the topic today.
Is that because I've never used Photoshop? Is that because it's best for straight lines to remove, and you had trouble because they were curved? Why are they still there? Why didn't you take them out?
Because I want to give the presentation today. If I remove them, then the topic just go out. Just go. Okay. Any other questions?
Not, let's thank the
Well, hello everybody. I'm going to be talking about slipstreaming today. So just an overview of my presentation. I'm going to start off by justifying why I want to talk about slipstreaming. And so I'll give a little bit of motivation for why I think it's interesting and where we can find slipstreaming around us. Okay, I'll then go a little bit into the theory behind slipstreaming. So it's quite a complicated theory. There's an awful lot going on in this area of physics. So I can't quite cover everything in a 15-minute presentation. So it's not a particularly mathematical presentation. It's going to be more of a qualitative discussion. So if you have any more mathematical questions, maybe that's suited to a discussion afterwards. Lastly, once I've gone over some of the theory of the physics, I'll then look at some applications that humans have devised for using slipstreaming, mainly applied to sports science. And then lastly, I'll just summarize all of the important points and just finish it all up. Okay, so this was my main motivation for this presentation. This is a picture that I took down at the lake in the park. And seeing as the motivation for this presentation was meant to be physics in nature, it seemed like a good place to start. So as you can see here, these two ducks are swimming behind one another. And they're not swimming side by side, but one behind the other. And so this is a perfect example of slipstreaming in nature. The first duck pushes through the medium of the water and the air. And by disturbing the medium, it then makes it easier for the second duck to swim behind him. So it's not only ducks that do this. I think we've already had a presentation on geese. And so you should be familiar with the famous V formation now of the way that geese fly. And that's another example of slipstreaming in nature. Because the first geese will push through the air, and that redistribution of air then makes it easier for the geese in the back of the procession to fly. And birds aren't the only animals that use this kind of method for travel. I did a little bit of Google searching, and I found that there's a type of lobster in the West Atlantic Ocean, and they use a very similar method. I think it's the Caribbean spiny lobster, and they've been documented to walk behind one another on the seabed to use this idea of slipstreaming. And so there are a couple of papers on it, which are quite interesting. So that is slipstreaming in nature, but animals aren't the only things in the world that use this. Humans have also devised ways of using slipstreaming. And so has anybody here seen any of the Olympic cycling? Yeah, cool. I mean, if not, maybe the Tour de France as well. So this is a perfect example of how humans have utilized the idea of slipstreaming. And so it turns out the Team GB are pretty good at doing this. I think they got about 12 medals in the end in the Olympics, as well as winning the Tour de France. So a bit of a plug there for GB. And I don't think it's because the British are born particularly good at cycling. I know a lot of people that can't even stay on a bike. So I think it's far more to do with the sports science involved with this team. And that's why they're so good. It's because they've got the idea of slipstreaming and aerodynamics down. And so they can use this to keep on winning. Okay, so I think gold medals is a pretty good motivation for why we want to study this. So now to look at a little bit of the theory. So back to my picture of the ducks. Now, I did practice this this presentation a couple of times before, and it got quite confusing because I was talking about one of the ducks affecting the other duck, and it all got a bit messy. So for the purpose of this presentation, the front duck is Dave and the back duck is Jim. And I don't know why I chose those names. I just figured the first one looked like a Dave and the second one a Jim. So and there you go. Okay, so as we were saying before, Dave is moving through the water. And as he moves, the water that he displaces is pushed around him. And this creates a wave. And so as we can see here, there's a wave that spreads out. And just with any other wave, it will eventually disperse and will lose that energy back to the system. Now, unfortunately, Dave isn't as streamlined as he would like to be. If he was perfectly streamlined, then he would have a laminar flow around him. But because he is a little bit more on the rotund side, what we find is that there's a turbulent flow that gets formed behind him as the water is redistributed. And this is what we call the slipstream. So this slipstream, because it's redistributed water, we find that it's actually moving with a velocity relative to Dave. And so this is very handy for Jim because it acts almost like a travelator. And so it imparts an initial velocity to Jim. So he can actually start moving without having to use any of his own power, which of course is very handy if you're Jim. One of the problems, though, that Dave comes into is that because he's pushing through the water, he has a normal pressure in front of him, but he has a slightly lower pressure behind him. And so what we actually find is that there's a net pressure on Dave. And this is a positive pressure, defined just the way that I have my pressure arrows. And so this means that there's actually a force pushing him backwards. And this is all due to the fact that he has a higher pressure in front of him, low pressure behind, and so that just stops him from moving quite as quickly. So it's pretty much a raw deal for Dave. Not only is he having to do all of the work, but by doing the work, he's also being slowed down. Now, it's not the end of the world for Dave, because there is a way in which he can speed up a little bit. And so to figure out what that is, we have to look at Jim. Okay, so as we already said, Jim has got a nice easy ride because he's on this travelator and he doesn't have to do very much work. Now, another interesting thing to point out with Jim is that because Dave has created this low pressure region in front of him, and Dave has created the low pressure region behind him, this means that there's a low pressure region in front of Jim and a more regular pressure region behind him. And so what you actually find happening is that there's another net pressure difference on Jim, but this time it gives him a slight force in the forwards direction. So again, life being Jim is nice and easy. But this does help out Dave a little bit. Because Jim is moving forwards, he's pushing into the air in front of him. And so what this does is actually reduce the low pressure region in front of Jim. And so this negates slightly the change in pressure on Dave. And so it means there's slightly less force on Dave and he can speed up a little bit. So although Jim is getting the better ride here because he's in the slipstream, he's also helping out Dave a little bit, who is going faster than he would be able to if he was just swimming independently. Okay, so that's the main physics behind the situation. It's quite simple. I mean, there is more math you can go into with turbulence and things. But for now, that is pretty much all I want to say on that. What we can do now is have a look at this theory and relate it to the cycling that I was talking about before. So, excuse the bad drawing, but all I had was paint, so this is as good as I could do. And I apologize that the people look naked as well. I didn't really think when I used the color pink in this. Okay, so this is an event that occurs in the velodrome in the Olympics. So you have track cycling and also road cycling. I've chosen to look at track cycling because in a velodrome you have still air, and so it means that a lot of the forces and pressure differences that you experience with slipstreaming are more evident in a velodrome arena. Okay, so this is the team pursuit. And effectively what happens is you have two different teams that start on either side of the velodrome, and the aim is to catch each other up. And whoever gets past their final position after a certain amount of laps will win the race. And it's not just about pedaling fast. There's an awful lot to do with aerodynamics and streamlining here as well. So as both of the teams move around, what we find is that if they can gain even a little bit of time on the other team, they can get into that slipstream. And so that means that they can capitalize on the other team going around the track, and so they can make themselves a little bit faster. As well as that, there's also the benefit that if you get a little bit closer to the back of the other team, they're also further away from your slipstream, and so you're stopping them from using yours to their own effect. Other things to note here is the aerodynamics involved. As you can see, they're all wearing tear-shaped hats, which I tried to do in paint somewhat successfully. And so this is all to do with the aerodynamics. Unlike Dave, who was quite a rotund duck, these guys want to be as streamlined as possible to create a laminar flow around themselves. And so what that means is that it's a nice smooth flow. Having a laminar flow means that you have less turbulent air behind you, which means that you get rid of that low pressure problem behind you, which can slow you down. In actual fact, if you manage a perfect laminar stream around you, you can actually produce a high pressure area behind you, which has the same effect as what happened to Jim, and so it can actually propel you forwards, which of course would be a very useful thing in a race like this. Okay, so what we've done today is we looked at the physics of slipstreaming. So in summary, we said that if you have a moving object moving through a medium, then it produces a low pressure behind it, high pressure in front of it, which creates forces. And also that because of the turbulent air or water behind that object, it means that it's easier for them to travel behind. Oh, and what I just said there, that you have a net force on an object because of the pressure differences. And whether you have a turbulent or a laminar flow allows you to either get faster or slower because of which way the net force is pointing. We also saw examples of slipstreaming in nature. So we spoke about ducks, geese, and lobsters. And we found that if animals are traveling in groups, then you have the front ones doing lots of work, the ones at the back, not so much. And if they change around where they are in the group, they can actually travel for longer periods of time. And that's really important because you can have more complex migratory habits and things because they can fly or swim for longer. And of course, it's very important what I just said. Okay, and then we looked at the applications in sport, namely competitive cycling. And the knowledge of aerodynamics and whether you're creating a laminar or a turbulent flow is very important because it can allow you to have better equipment and techniques. And also that knowledge of slipstreaming can be a very important tactical idea because you can capitalize on your opponent's slipstream to go faster. And that's it. Thank you very much. Questions?
The two ducks in your picture, mm-hmm. judging from their coloration, they're mallard ducks and they're female.
Oh, in which case I apologize, and I guess they're Davet and Jimet, so I apologize, and next time I'll change that.
So can I look at the picture with ducks?
Yeah, of course. There are lots of them. Is there a particular one that you would like to look at?
Yeah. So according to the picture, does this mean that it is more difficult to move for Dave than for Jim?
Yes, definitely. Because he's the one having to push through the medium, it's harder for him.
So this would probably mean that in group cycling, it is more difficult to move for the person who moves at the front, right?
Exactly. I probably should have elaborated on that a little bit.
This is probably the reason why when cyclists come to the finish, then it may be not clear who will move first and who will win. Because the cyclist who moves behind the first cyclist has more efforts and more chance to circumvent the cyclist who moved the first and come to finish the first, right?
Yeah, it's actually very difficult to tell, especially in things like the Tour de France. Even if you have, say, a breakaway group, you may have two or three cyclists that are on opposing teams. So you think they're all vying for first place, but in actual fact, what they're doing is cycling around each other, each taking turns to go in front, which is, you know, quite interesting, really, because it's almost like a temporary alliance that they have. And so they take it in turns to go at the front because it's harder. But then at the end, every man for himself, and they'll break off and sprint.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
What are the sort of length scales involved in, you know, to take advantage of the slipstream? And is that the reason for the size of the velodrome?
That's a really good point, actually. With, for example, the ducks, they have to be quite close to each other. Or from what I can tell, they don't seem to be that far away when it happens. I haven't really experimented with this. But in a velodrome, because the air is so still, because it's a contained unit, it means that even if you were to, say, be cycling on your own, by the time you got round again, you would probably still be in your own slipstream because the air was so still to start with. So although obviously it's more advantageous to be closer because the pressure differences will be larger, you can probably still have the effect on other sides. But yeah, I think that's probably one of the reasons why it is quite large. Anything else?
Maybe a stupid question. So if you have incompressible fluid, how come that you have different pressures on your pressure?
I don't think I said at any time that I was modeling water as incompressible. But also there is the slipstream in the air as well, and so that's part of the effect. But I'm pretty sure it happens in the water as well.
You can have the difference for incompressible fluids. So if you look at Bernoulli's equation, behind the object, the velocity of fluid is different. So this is the reason for the pressure. So the fluid can be perfectly incompressible.
Okay. I think one of the problems is I've modeled it quite simply. There are obviously other factors rather than just the pressures being different.
Questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker.
Thank you.
Speaker is Natasha, and she's going to talk about the nature of movement and the movement of nature.
Well, hi everyone. Today I'm going to talk about neuron loss, and I'm trying to explain them with some photos that I took during the walk at the park. And well, my title is The Nature of Movement and the Movement of Nature. The structure of the talk will be as follows. In the introduction, I'm going to show some pictures that I took in the park and motivate my talk and telling you what my objectives are. In the second part that I call the movement of nature, I am going to introduce to the files that study motion in physics, and I am trying to explain the intuitive notion that we have of motion. In the third part, I am talking about Newton's laws and explain the photos that we've seen before with a more physical or mathematical frame. And then the conclusions. So, the introduction. What do we see when we look? In the park, we can see child's playing. we can also see people walking around, animals lying on the surface of the lake, a bird lying on a branch of a tree, and if you're lucky, we can see science having fun. So the objective of this talk is to introduce the three neuron laws, analyzing the nature that in we live. So, the movement of nature. The fields that study motion in physics are the kinematics that study the movement of bodies. And once we can establish an equation, it's possible to determine the position and the velocity of bodies at any time. And then dynamics, that is the study of the causes of a body to change the position and its velocity. So the intuitive notions that we have of movement is that a body will change its velocity if a force acts on it. That's we can see it in this graph. This girl is playing in this toy at the park, and we see that when he's on the top of the toy, the forces cancel, so she's not moving, but when she decides to go down through the toy, the forces will start to act on her and change its velocity until she goes down. Then we also know that forces has a direction and a magnitude. So here we are. Sergio is trying to push Mary through the hall in the time room, and we know that if he push Mary in this direction, so she will move in this direction also, and depending on the magnitude of the force that he is doing, Mary will move slowly or faster. We also know that exist forces that are perpendicular to the direction of movement, and these forces don't change the velocity of the body. This is the circular motion. It's very difficult to have a picture of circular motion because we are always in the gravitational field here in the Earth. So the most similar picture that I have for semi-circular motion is this child playing in this toy. We have cords here that are making a force to this circle here, and the sum of both of them gives a force that is perpendicular to the motion of this object. But well, we can see that this object in fact is accelerated. That's why, because these tiles have weight, so there's another force is acting on them. Well, another important thing that we must have in account if we are talking about motion is mass. Because we know that the same force would have different effects on bodies with different masses. So we can explain it with this picture. We know that if a little child with less mass than he would reach a higher altitude with the same impulse. So another force that maybe is not that trivial to see in our daily life is the friction force. We have both two friction forces. The first one is the static force that appears when I do a force into an object, and this object is not sliding on a surface. That's maybe the force that allowed us to walk and a car to move. And then the dynamic friction force appears in a body which is sliding on a surface. Maybe if I threw a ball in this surface, I will see that it won't change its velocity and it will stop at the end. So this is an example of a thing that we can see every day of frictional force. He is doing force on his foot, and so immediately the floor is doing a friction force that opposes to this motion, and that's what allows him to walk. Well, now I'm going to talk about the nature of movement, trying to explain how neuron laws can explain all the things that we see around us. So in 1887, Newton published his three laws of motion. These are the law of inertia, the fundamental law of dynamics, and the law of action and reaction. So the first one states that if there are no forces acting on a body, or all these forces cancel with each other, then the velocity of the body would not change. We can see here, in this flying object, that we have ropes here that are acting on the on this object. And we also have the wave. So these three forces cancel, and this object is not moving, has not velocity. The second law states that if a force acts on a body, its velocity will change. The body will be accelerated. And here we have the equation that relates the force that is acting on a body with the mass and deceleration of the body. It's important to note here that the acceleration is proportional to 1 over m. So m, that is the mass of a body, is a resistance of the body to movement. That's why if we are trying to push a chair, maybe this chair, would be easy to us if we are trying to pull with the same impulse a car or this object. And here we have our models again. If Sergio wants to move the chairs alone, well, it will have to do to the chair less action to the in order to move it in, I don't know, 1 meter per second. And if Mary sits on the chair, it has to do a greater force to move it on that velocity. Well, and the third law states that if a body applies a force to another, this other will react to this action applying a force with the same direction, with the opposite direction and same magnitude of the first one. This is what we call the action and reaction law. And we can see in this picture here that we have glasses and cups here on a table. These cups have weight, so the gravitational force is acting on it, but it's not moving. That's because this table is applying the same magnitude force in an opposite direction. So, the conclusions. During this talk, we've seen pictures that we could have taken in a normal day walk. We also related them with the intuitive notions that we have of movement. And then we have introduced the neuron laws to try to explain in a more physical frame these pictures. So we can conclude that we are not just around by nature, but also by physics. Well, thank you very much. Question? That was simple. I think you don't have questions.
Somebody has a question. I have a question. So it always was puzzling to me why the first law doesn't fall from the second law. If I apply no force, I have no acceleration.
Oh, well, it would be. You're meaning why the first law is not the same as the.
Not a trivial consequence.
Well, that's a good question, I think. Maybe we can discuss it. Do you have an idea of what? Yeah.
Well, the first law is something like the definition of the inertial system.
Okay.
And then you say, well, so there exists an inertial system. That's a statement of the first law. And the second law is actually, in this inertial system, I have this simple force formula. That's like more modern formulation. Questions?
If I can elaborate on the... there is actually a physical case where the second law doesn't tell you what happens, but the first law does. Because you can have, for example, if you have a specific type of hill, you can have a ball that rolls up, and as it gets higher and higher, it slows down, until it reaches the top and then stops. It's just the right height. But since the laws of nature are time reversible, the reverse would be possible. Namely, you could have a ball sitting on top, just wait, and suddenly it would start rolling. According to second law, it would be possible because it's time reversible, but the first law forbids it.
questions to the presentation. Yeah.
Where did you find these hands-on models?
Well, you're the most pretty guys here, so I decided to take a picture of you. Please, yeah, don't feel hurt. I know they break hard with choosing them.
And so you're an enthusiastic photographer? Or
oh, no, it's like I have a lot of photos and I don't have a good idea, so I decided to explain the neural log with the photos I see, because I think it's important to us to kind of understand physics in all day environment. So we are just theoretical physics, so we are, maybe it's hard for us to, like, black holes in nature, of quantum mechanics in nature, so that's a simple thing with the nature. Physics in nature.
No other questions? Let us thank the speaker.
Thank you.
So our next speaker is Ruben, and he's going to talk about the scale of nature, or how dangerous are giant mutated ants.
Yes. Hello, everybody. I'll get right to the picture that I've taken. Here you see it. It's obviously an ant. And now I wonder what your intuition says about the following scenario. Say we take this ant and we make it as big as a human being. I'm wondering about your intuition, namely, is physics scale invariant for this example? In other words, will the physics be the same for the large ant as for the small ant? Will the ant have back pain or something? Is there a difference for the ant? So we have this question, and I want to do a small poll just for intuition. So everybody who thinks, yes, nature is scale invariant, at least for this example, can they raise their hands? Okay, no one. The intuition says no. Okay, everybody? No intuition? One person. Okay, so now I'm kind of in a pickle, because my intuition says yes, and I was going to discuss that. But I'm hoping that maybe there was some sort of misunderstanding. Wait, so, well, first the overview. What's the problem with the intuition? No problem, sure. Then the first solution. It's already presented then. Then the intermezzo will bring us to dimensionless constants, and then we will bring a more definite solution. But maybe I can convince you of my intuition, and then you see the problem. My intuition says, if you take an ant and you enlarge it to the size of a human being, or you take a normal ant and you look really closely, that there is kind of a symmetry between those two cases, and that you would expect to see the same thing happening. But there is a problem with this intuition. Namely, when you look at an ant and you zoom in, for example, an atom becomes larger, right? But when you make an ant bigger, you just add more atoms. So there is a dimensionless constant that changes in this situation, namely the length of an atom relatively to the length of an ant. But it does not change in this situation, right? So there's a dimensionless constant that changes in one situation and not in the other. And more generally, if you have a physical system and you change some parameters, then this change will be detectable if and only if there are dimensionless constants that change. This might sound strange. For example, you have a book by Gumov, Mr. Tompkins in Wonderland, and in it he describes what the world would look like if the velocity of light were like 1 meter per second. And he says, well, we would see relativistic effects in everyday life, etc. But actually, he's not quite right on that one, because this problem is ill-defined. When you change the speed of light, that's just not well-defined. You might say, it is. I mean, you change the speed of light and all the other fundamental physical constants stay the same. That is impossible, because there are different, because there are relations that have to be true for fundamental constants. For example, you have that the Bohr radius is equal to some Planck constant, velocity of light, etc. So if you change the velocity of light, some other constant has to change too. And you have to specify what also changes. For example, one case can be that the speed of light is 1 meter per second, but consequently, the Bohr radius, the radius of hydrogen, hydrogen atom, also shrinks. So sure, light will go a lot slower, but everything in the universe will be a lot smaller, so light will still look just as fast to inside of that universe. So there would be no detectable change. However, if you change the fine structure constant, this is a dimensionless constant, that will always be detectable. For example, you can show that, oh, okay, I'll leave it at that, because I don't have a lot of time. So with this new insight, let's look again at those two conflicting pictures, zooming in versus making the end bigger. So we've already found a dimensionless constant that changes in one situation. But this constant does not really embody the fact that when you size an end up, it will actually collapse. So why does an end collapse when you make it as big as us? That was actually, my intuition said it would not collapse because I would not think of being different than zooming in, but apparently it collapses. So we're looking for a dimensionless quantity that changes when you make the end large, and it also characterizes the instability when the end becomes too big. For that, we need a model, and I have a semi-toy model of an ant leg. Here you see the macroscopic picture, and the leg is tilted as a slant with angle theta. And this is the microscopic view with atoms. So this is the lower part, this is the upper part. And in my semi-toy model, the upper part shifts a bit downwards due to the gravity pulling it down, but then it stays there due to certain intermolecular electric forces, which I won't specify because we don't have the time. Anyway, so we have this dislocation epsilon. Now, I propose to look at a dimensionless quantity, epsilon over alpha naught. So this would embody the dislocation of the atoms relative to the intermolecular distance. And indeed, if this becomes too big, the bonds are broken and the end will collapse. And in my specific model, I can calculate this. And this gives this formula, where MA is the atomic mass, A naught is Bohr radius, and with K I mean Coulomb's constant and Coulomb force. Okay, now when you make the end bigger, you can assume that all these more fundamental constants stay the same. So only this L dependence, by which I mean the typical length of the end, is important. So if the end becomes big enough, this ratio will become big enough, and the leg must collapse and the end must collapse. Interestingly, we can also use this, for example, in the case of zooming in. And in that case, well, for example, the Bohr radius will change, right? If you zoom in, as I said earlier, the atoms will become bigger. And of course, the radius is proportional to the proportion that we've zoomed in. However, this would imply that this dimensionless constant is proportional to L squared, which would mean that zooming in makes the end collapse, which makes no sense. But we're being too naive. Namely, other things change too when you zoom in. For example, the gravitational acceleration changes. This might seem weird, but we're talking about effective values, right? What it looks like in your worldview. It's easier to explain with velocity. If we're just here in real space, not zoomed in, and we have an object that moves at 1 centimeter per second, and now we zoom in 100 times, then it looks to us in our worldview that it moves at 1 meter per second because we don't know where we're zoomed in, as it were. So velocity changes proportionally to L. And one can continue the argument to show that acceleration also scales with this. So we get another factor of L, L proportionality. And well, now we got L cubed, which is even worse. But if you can continue the argument, which I won't do now, and even the mass and the electric charges effectively change when you zoom in, and you'll get L cubed in the denominator, in the numerator, in the bottom, and they cancel out, so that indeed, when you zoom in, the dimensionless constant stays the same. So more generally, again, only changes in dimensionless constants are physically meaningful. And when you zoom in, for example, you have dimensionful changes, but of course, no dimensionless changes. Oh, that's an excellent. Thank you. Are there any questions?
OK, well, thank the speaker.
Yeah. Has anyone actually done a calculation of something to the effect of how big an ant can get before it collapses?
I have not found any material on it.
Maybe we should do that for like our essay project. How big can we make the table?
Yeah, I'm totally at a loss to make a few conclusions.
Which part?
Yeah, I mean, what does it mean by say the change is detectable?
Well, for example, like, do you remember this part about changing the velocity of light? So you might think if I make the velocity of light 1 meter per second, that would be detectable, correct?
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily detectable. It's an ill-defined problem, because.
Why do you say it's not detectable? Say I drive a car. Say it's, I mean, initially I drive at 100 kilometers per hour, then I turn it to 60 something.
Yes, but the point is, if you change C, for example, atoms will become smaller, and...
So here, I mean, the changes are only, say, that's only the change for the physical constant, universal constant.
Sorry?
I mean, do you mean the change for of the universal constant only?
Doesn't
because it, I mean, in this case, say you drive a car, change the speed, then definitely it's detectable.
Right, but then you've also changed a dimensionless thing. So my statement is, if you have a physical system and no dimensionless constant changes, then it's not detectable. But for that car, if you make it faster, there will be a dimensionless change. The amount of meters it can travel in a certain second relative to the car length. I mean, that's a bad example, but yeah. it's not clear. Well, there will be a dimensionless change in that example, for example.
Well, in that example, surely you could change the units of time using C, which you haven't changed. And then
so wait, which example to be?
So with this car,
okay.
You could compare the speed of the car to the speed of light.
Okay, yeah, for example, yeah, sorry, yeah.
If I compare the speed of the car to another speed of the car, well, I change both.
Right. So,
the ratio constant.
So if you continue and change all speeds, then it won't be measurable.
So it means, I mean, so whatever changes, it can kind of change the matrix of the whole universe.
Right, and it's undetectable. It will be detectable for like a God entity through the whole entire universe, but inside the universe, you will not be able to detect any.
Okay, so here when we say the change, it means you change all the, like, if you want to change the length, then you change all the scale of the whole universe, not just say one single quantum dimensions.
Right, that's the result. If you change no dimensionless constant, it's actually just rescaling up everything.
I'm just lost. Mm. Oh, what do you mean by the change? Okay.
Yeah.
other questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker. Okay, so our last speaker for this session is Poon, and he's going to talk about buffalo sparks, waterfowl plumage, and surviving winter in Canada. Please go ahead.
So, can I read him?
Yeah.
So, on the last one, my favorite is one is about the waterfowl plumage at the waterfowl plumage at of the ducks and geese at the waterfowl park and how to fly winter in Canada. And after mentioning my simple reason why I'm interested in this topic, and then I will move to the describe briefly about the waterfowl plumage and smoke conductivity, and hopefully at the end of my presentation, I will give you some advice about how to survive winter here in Canada. And my motivation is that because I'm from a tropical region, so my first thing I worry about when I come here is how to survive winter here in Canada. And I will tell you that we can find the answer of this question by studying the duck and geese at the Kuala Lumpur Park. And let's find out why. You know that it comes to me that I don't know why duck and geese at Kuala Lumpur Park can survive in such a really severe cold weather in Canada. And it seems to me that their special plumage must play some important role in protecting them from the elements of weather. And why? As you all know, the heat loss of ducks and geese are mostly through their plumage, and according to the thermodynamics, heat transfer through the plumage through three main channels. And the first is through the conduction and convection through the air. And second is through the conduction along solid elements of the feather and through the ultraviolet radiation. But some research have shown that feathers are mostly composed of keratin, which it has a considerably low conductivity, and also the heat loss through radiation is pretty low compared to other channels. So in most of the case, waterfowl must deal with the heat loss through the conduction through the air. And why? And how can they deal with this with the heat loss through the conduction and convection? It's due to the special structure of their plumage. As you may know, duck and geese usually have three main types of feathers: the contour feather, the down feather, and the fly feather. I don't mention the fly feather here. Here is the picture of the contour feather I took from the Wikipedia. And contour feather is the outermost feather of the ducks, and it forms a protective outer shell of the ducks. And one important property of this feather is that it forms a layer which keeps the air and snow from penetrating into the skin of the birds. And at the end of at the end of the sub of the control filter, you can find another layers of filter called after filter. And the innermost layers of filter, which lay just next to the skin of the filter, are the down filter. It have the locking bubbles and have the lifty appearance. And between the down filter and the control filters are the semi blooms. I don't know. Which serve as an extra layer to keep warm for the waterfall. So it should be noticed here that plumes of a waterfall are arranged in a tree in many layers. And this pattern is really important because, as you know that, why this is important? Because the counter filter of which is the outer layers of the filter, they have to keep some to trap some air in the inner and keep the water and snow from penetrating into the skins of the bird, the down filter, which is the innermost layer piece of the bird, have the fluffy appearance, which is very useful to keep track many pockets of air just next to the skin of the birds. So the pattern have the birds to protect them from the elements of the weather. Therefore, so through my analysis, I can come to some conclusion that in order to prevent the cold ducks and geese may have the filter which has the pattern contain many layers, and from this just analysis, we can guess that we cannot find any Skydops birds with filter like look like this because they cannot survive in winter of Canada, or they must migrate in winter. That's right. And also, this can help me to answer my question, because I don't know why. Then I mentioned in the Bioscience Welcome Guide that we have to resting in layers. And now I understand why, and I advise you that we should agree with her to rest in many layers in order to survive winter in Canada. But what I have done is just some qualitative assumption, so it's not enough to tell me that how many layers should I wear to survive in Canada, because even in summertime, I still have to wear sweater. So I don't know. And this is my presentation.
Questions how to dress properly. Yeah.
So what's the coldest it normally gets in your hometown in Vietnam?
Around 24 degrees.
24?
Yeah.
Okay. And in the summer, it's typically?
35.
No, in the high temperatures.
In high temperature?
Yeah.
In high temperature, again, up to about 35.
I see.
Yeah.
What city did you live in?
In Ho Chi Minh City.
Ho Chi Minh?
Yeah, Ho Chi Minh City.
Okay. So where's that compared to Saigon? Is that south or north?
Oh, it is Saigon.
Oh, that is Saigon.
Yeah.
So what's the other big city in Vietnam?
Hanoi. In the
okay.
North part.
Is
yeah.
that hotter?
It is colder. It's colder.
Colder, okay.
Yeah.
You have another chicken without feathers, or a bird without feathers. Is that like from your country, from your hometown?
Yeah, we can find
is
a lot
very
of
very common like
yeah.
that. Pink.
Not pink. Oh. I don't know.
Is it not pink?
The ducks and geese that you saw in the park, a lot of them actually don't stick around in Canada for the winter. They go to the northern United States.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, they like to migrate. So their feathers are sort of designed to keep them warm in the spring and the fall, but not necessarily the coldest that we can get in the depths of the winter when they are long gone. Did you sort of take that into account?
I agree with you, and I know that. But basically, people here have to wear in many layers. That's a fact. And that we can learn from ducks and geese, even in the fall. And that's the point I want to make here.
Any other questions? Okay, let us thank the speaker.